So, Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. Seeing the crowds, he, this is Jesus, Matthew speaking of, went up on the mountain, and when he had sat down, his disciples came to him. Obviously, if you think back to Exodus 19, you're getting this mirrored situation where Jesus is connecting dots, helping us to see some of the purposes behind what he's about to do. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied." And I love that picture of satisfaction. Some translations say they will be filled. That's a Thanksgiving Day meal term, by the way. It's stuffed, so full. You know that feeling like on the other side of the turkey or the ham, you know, you smell it cooking and you're so hungry. It's like, oh, it's going to be so good. And then you eat and you eat and you eat and then you more dessert. And by the end, you're just like stuffed. That's the word right there. I kid you not. It's literally a word. It's like just, wow, you could not eat anything more. That's the promise. That's the hope we have. Righteousness filled to the brim. Verse 7, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." We've been journeying through this incredible part of Scripture that's known as the Sermon on the Mount. These verses I just read, often referred to simply as the Beatitudes, statement of blessing, statement of what it looks like to have a life that is, sometimes we translate it sometimes as happy, but we know happiness, that English word, the way we would use it now, just is, it's too light. It's not weighty enough. And so we look for other words. How do we articulate this? It's like joy and contentment, this sense that God looks with approval upon a people or a person who is living out these truths and this reality. And so we live no matter what the circumstances with this knowledge of just this profound sense of fullness and wellness because of the truth of what Jesus is saying. And so we've been working our way through. Last week, as I mentioned, I was out in Falkland, so I was actually preaching the same passage that Pastor Andrew was preaching here. We didn't compare notes, so it actually was really fun because service out there starts at 9:15. We live just sort of north of town, so I didn't have enough time after coffee time in Falkland to get all the way back here to physically be here to hear what Andrew said, but we did make it home. So I was on the live stream watching Pastor Andrew, having just preached the passage. I got good news. We were pretty much on the same page, which is always good, you know, when you're not quite sure how all those things are going to land. But that was last week. We made it all the way up to the end of verse 5, which means this week we're going to try to walk through verse 6 and 7, these statements about righteousness and statements about mercy. Now, Jesus, having worked through those first three, and I think you're probably starting to get this sense of the logic, maybe that feels like a really dry sort of word, but the flow of the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with the statement of poverty, of spiritual bankruptcy, right? And kind of having to wrestle through, why would you consider someone who recognizes they are spiritually bankrupt to be happy or joyful? Like, wouldn't that be the opposite in many ways? And in many ways, it is, as we'll see from the next statement that Jesus makes about mourning. But you understand that in order to be able to receive Christ and treasure him in the way that Scripture presents him to us, as the one who died for our sins to make us right with God, to carry the weight of all of that, in order for us to understand the value of that gift, we have to understand the profound need for it. Otherwise, the news of Jesus is just sort of like, And maybe you've run across people who have said things like, well, that's good for you, right? I'm happy for you. If you've got Jesus, that's great. I don't need Jesus. It's only when we come to understand the profound need that the goodness and wonder of the gospel makes sense. And so, why are we blessed? Because this is the entryway into understanding who Jesus is. I'm spiritually bankrupt. Now I'm ready to cling to him who has given himself for me. Now, some people hear the news of spiritual poverty and they maybe even the lights go on. They look in the mirror and they realize not all is well, not just with the whole world, but right here. And their response isn't to cling to Jesus. Their response is to do anything but or everything else but. They try to entertain themselves. They try to pursue pleasure. They try to compare themselves with others and go, well, I know I'm spiritually bankrupt, but I'm not as bad as that guy. Anything to minimize that sense of emptiness inside. They don't do what Jesus is saying we ought to do in this next statement, which is to mourn over the condition. So you start to see the flow, right? We recognize our spiritual poverty. A right response to that is to mourn over that. A next right response then is to have that begin to affect our relationships. And so this idea of meekness starts to emerge, where I am now amazed, not that people treat me badly, but that people treat me as well as they do. After all, isn't it true, once you really know you, once you've peered into your own heart and seen that what's inside is not that wonderful, that we're not amazed that people would treat us badly. We're amazed when people treat us well. Like, after all, like, have you ever had that thought go through? It's like, oh, if you knew me, if you really knew me, you would not think that well. And so this meekness begins to shape our relationships. Now, when Jesus uses the quote from Psalm 37, which is what's going on in that little statement, it brings to mind the entire psalm. And the psalm is a picture of meekness. It has all sorts of interesting pieces that connect in that psalm. It starts with a profound trust in God, that we understand he is faithful and he is good and he can be counted on, which leads then in the psalmist's sort of, you know, depiction of meekness to being able to wait upon him. After all, once you know you can trust him, then you can wait on him. You know he's good, you know he's wise, you know he can be depended on. And so rather than rushing ahead or getting upset over him or frustrated by him, you're able to sit there and say, I can trust him. I know he's for me and he is good. Which then leads, again, Psalm 37 to an amazing realization that if he is trustworthy and if I can count on his timing, then even when people do ill against me, I don't need to fret. I don't need to grab justice and take vengeance into my own hands. I can trust that he will be the one who will do that far, far better than I ever could. That's actually the picture then of meekness coming from Psalm 37, which, interestingly enough, if you go back to, this would be the key text in all of Scripture of meekness. It's in Numbers chapter 12, which is a picture of Moses. When you read it, it's actually a little bit of a puzzling thing because actually Moses wrote Genesis to Deuteronomy. And so Moses wrote Numbers chapter 12, which records Moses writing of himself that he is the meekest person to ever live, which kind of, if you ever read it, you're like, well, that kind of ruins it a little bit. But the story he records there is an incredible portrait of what meekness looks like. And it actually brings all of the elements from Psalm 37 to bear in Numbers chapter 12, where Moses is, he is opposed by those who are closest to him, opposed in incredibly hostile ways. You would think everything inside of him would say, here's an opportunity to throw my weight around. I am the leader of this nation, and he does nothing. He waits upon God. He trusts God. And God is the one who rights the wrong. And God is the one who brings justice. And we have this picture of what meekness looks like. You're not going to throw your weight around. You're going to trust and rely on God to bring about whatever God would want. And you're amazed at how good it is because you know your spiritual bankruptcy. Now, that's kind of where we've come to. And now verse 6 and 7, this idea of hungering and thirsting for something, which kind of starts to make sense, don't you think? If you know you're spiritually bankrupt and you're mourning over it and you're amazed people are treating you as well as they do, it's a picture of emptiness, isn't it? It's like, I'm bankrupt. I don't bring a lot to the table. I'm not a wonderful person. I'm not God's gift to humanity. I'm a mess. That's emptiness, which then leads very naturally to this next statement, that we begin to hunger and thirst for something. We need to be filled because we've recognized our emptiness. Now, this is an amazing statement. And in fact, probably there is not a person in this room who would disagree with the basic premise that Jesus is going after. Even if you don't agree with who he is, you don't agree with his teachings, you would understand that when you look around at the world, there are people out there, all of us, who hunger and thirst for something. We are in pursuit of something to be filled with. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11, gives us this incredible statement of how God has made us. It says this, God has made everything beautiful in its time, and he's put eternity in man's heart. In other words, he has created you with a longing for something more because you just were designed that way. Now, we go and try to fill that in an amazing number of ways. We pursue work, we pursue relationships, we pursue money, we pursue power, we pursue sex, we pursue influence, we pursue anything to try to fill this longing because we hunger and thirst for something. Wonderful quotes throughout history, because people just have recognized this. Augustine said, "Thou hast made us for thyself, and our heart is restless until it rests in thee." It's like, I know there's more. Have you ever had one of those moments where you go off in pursuit of something? If I could just get there, if I could just get that thing, that job, that possession, that relationship, then I will be happy. I'll feel satisfied. And then you get it. You're kind of like the kid at Christmas. You've watched this, right? The kid at Christmas, I was one of those kids. Like, if I just get this toy, right? Picture the 5 or 6-year-old version of me, a super annoying kid. Please, 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 you know? If I just get this thing, then I'll be happy. I will never need another thing if I just get this thing. And then you go out and you buy the gift. You put it under the tree if you do that. And the kid opens it. And January 8th comes along, and you know, as a parent, you're like, hey, where's that thing that was going to transform your life? It's like, I don't know. It's kind of off to the side, because once you had it, you realize it didn't work. And so it's tragically ironic, isn't it, that we can see it in kids and we can see it in others, and we're totally blind to ourselves. Here's the reality. I suspect if we were to be honest, we're not going to do this. But if we just sort of stopped for a few minutes, and instead of turning to our neighbor to greet someone, we turned to our neighbor and said, I'm going to be honest for a moment. Here's the thing I'm pursuing, and I think if I got this thing, I'd be happy. I bet you most of us would have the thing. If I could just get to this stage of life, if I could just accomplish this thing or have this relationship or have, you know, this level of finances or whatever the thing is, or go to this place or be able to do this experience. There's even Christian forms of this where if I could just get to this conference, if I could just have this spiritual high, then I'd be happy. Here's the bad news. The bad news is that's not going to work. You will get the thing and you will still be restless. C.S. Lewis put it this way, I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, then the most probable explanation is I was made for another world. You hear what he's saying? It's like there's not going to be a thing, a possession, a person, an experience that fills that, because you were not made to be filled by that. You were made to be filled with something else. Probably the most provocative quote about this is one from one of my favorite authors, C.K. Chesterton, who said this. He said, every man who knocks on the door of a brothel is searching for God. He doesn't mean God's in the brothel. He just meant it's that we pursue all sorts of things, and most of them are crazy and broken and dysfunctional, but really what we're after is God, and we just don't know it. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now, I've not been hungry very often. It's kind of apparent. You can see that. About 30 years ago, though, I remember being hungry. I know it's kind of sad that I have to go back that far, right? Usually I get hungry about 4:45 every day, 11:45. My stomach's well-trained. But about 30 years ago, a buddy of mine and I decided we were going to hike Golden Ears. Don't know if you know Golden Ears. It's a mountain just kind of Maple Ridge area down to the coast. We were foolish. We were also reasonably fit back when we were like 17 and 18. And so being ill-prepared, we just sort of started going up the mountain. The first time we attempted this feat, we literally had made next to no preparation. And by the time we were a few hours, it's a 25, I actually Googled it. I'm like, how long was it? 25 kilometer round trip. So a couple, 2-3 hours up, you're starting to get higher and higher kind of up the side of the mountain, and it was raining and it was sort of slippery, and there's this section of the trail where it's quite steep. And I remember we were on this section, we're just in running shoes and jeans and a t-shirt, and you know, we're climbing up this thing, and all of a sudden these people come and they've got like these poles and these like fancy shoes with like metal things attached to them, and they're like hiking, and we're like sliding down, and off they go, and they've got all this fancy gear. That was the moment we decided to turn back. It's like, hold on a second. If that's the kind of gear you need to get up the mountain, we probably aren't ready. Now, you would think we would get the gear before we tried it again. That would not be the case, because as I said, we were fit but foolish. The second attempt, we knew enough to know that we would wait for a little bit better weather, and then we knew we needed some food. This is the 18-year-old version of me. So we went to Subway and decided a foot-long sub each would be the way to conquer Golden Ears Provincial Park. Of course, when you're in a Subway, no, this is all you're going to eat for the day. You get everything on it, right? Have you ever done that at Subway? When they ask you, like, would you like some of this? Yes. Which sauce would you like? All of them. Like, just load it up with calories, okay? Then you take the sub, and they put it in a plastic bag, right? You got the picture now? It's in a plastic bag. It's wrapped up in the bag. You throw the bag at in a backpack with your water bottles. And then you start walking. Can you picture what happens to a sub in a plastic bag, hot on your back with water bottles? It's like running it through a washing machine. And by about 10 kilometers in, when you're really, really hungry and it was time to eat something, open our bags, and it was like a sub smoothie. It was like liquefied. And we couldn't eat it. I just couldn't bring it. Now, probably if we were that desperate, we could have. But I just remember back then, it's like you're now way up this mountain, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, this is what hungry feels like. It's a longing. It's like it hurts. And Jesus comes along and says, that longing is not the problem. The problem is when we settle for anything other than the right thing. Now he points us to what's the right thing? Righteousness. We're to pursue righteousness. And the promise is this: if we pursue righteousness, we will get happiness. You know, most of us are pursuing happiness. Right? Isn't that kind of a funny thing? It's almost like we would write it like this. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for blessedness. That somehow we could pursue and attain blessedness as though it's a thing in and of itself. And Jesus wants us to understand, no, it's a byproduct. You'll never get happy by pursuing happy. And when I say it like that, we go, well, yeah, no one would ever think like that. But if you're a parent or a grandparent, have you ever found yourself having these words slip out of your mouth? I just want them to be happy. They're only going to get that when they are pursuing the right thing. We're only going to get that when we pursue the right thing. So what is the right thing? Righteousness is what Jesus tells us. So what is that? Now, scripturally speaking, there are three ways the word righteous is used. There's a legal sense. This is how Paul often uses it. You go read Romans. This is going to be what he enters into. And the idea is we are sinners. We've broken the commands of God. We've missed the standard. And so we ought to, before a holy and just God, pay the penalty of sin, which, if you've read scripture, you know is death. Like, that's the legal sense. And then Paul is going to wrestle through, what has God done to make it possible to allow righteousness to triumph? And so you get into all these great million-dollar theological terms like justification and atonement and all these kind of things that all describe that God has sent his son to die in our place. It's kind of what it boils down to. And the gift is there that's offered to us if we, by faith, trust Jesus and receive him as the treasure of our life. That's one sense of righteousness. The other two senses feed into it. They're not all detached. So I'm making it kind of a little bit of a false dichotomy or trichotomy, if there's three. The second sense is moral, and this has to do with me, my brokenness, the fact that I am a liar and I am a hypocrite, right? And all of us have some issue where if it was laid bare and we were to open up our hearts to the world, there's something really unpleasant. Hey, that's the moral sense, and we are called to moral righteousness. We are to be people who live well and honorably and pursue the will of God. But there's a third sense, and the third sense is a social sense. This is where we look around, and probably you've had this happen, where you look around in the world, and maybe you've had the same thought go through your head as often goes through my head. It's like, there is something wrong in this world. There's injustice. There are abuses of people. There are some seriously messed up things happening, not just in my heart, but all around. Those are the three senses. And I think what is going on here in this passage has to do a lot with those last two. Not that Jesus is going to be unconcerned with the legal sense. Obviously, he came for that reason. But the way he is teaching, what he's going to show us next, feel a lot like it has to do with the fact that he wants us to, through the strength and power of God, so let's just make sure we see that peace. Go read Isaiah 61 if there is any doubt of where the righteousness is going to come from. But through God working in us, we're going to pursue something very different. So what's the different thing? Well, Jesus is actually going to answer that for us. And the answer, we got to we have to just kind of be Bible geeks for a minute. So just track along for just a minute here with me. You notice there's eight Beatitudes from verse 3 to verse 10. Verse 11 is kind of like the to be continued part. It carries on and it feels very similar, but notice verse 10 and verse 3 have the same ending. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God. So it's bookends, right? And then you have the first three Beatitudes that speak to this issue of emptiness, right? We're spiritually bankrupt, we're mourning, we're meek, that lead us to this point of saying, well, now I'm hungering for something outside of me. I don't have righteousness in me. I need some external thing to happen. Then notice what happens in the very last one. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. So bear this in mind. Verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. But by the end, isn't it interesting? Now blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. So something happens between verse 6 and verse 10, where the hungering and the absence of righteousness is now replaced by the presence of righteousness, which leads to persecution. So just in case you think, okay, I'm going to live the way Jesus wants, and it's going to be awesome. It will be in virtually every regard. But if you're going to wait for the world to just look on and go, oh, well done. Just prepare yourself for what Jesus has to say. He's going to say, many people will persecute you for living the way I'm going to call you to. But between verse 6 and verse 10, I think you have your answer to what is the righteousness Jesus is calling us to. And he's going to point out three things. We'll look at one here in just a moment and then two next week. Mercy, purity in heart, and peacemaking. And notice these are things that come out of fullness. Right? Showing mercy to others, pursuing peacemaking, not just being peaceful people, but actually pursuing peacemaking. And a purity of heart, when we get there, we'll see that it's not just me on my own sitting in a little spot in the bush, just me with my pure heart, that there's a relational peace to this. This spills out to the world. And so we've got this beginning. Here's our beginning thesis. Let me try it this way. That the righteousness Jesus is pointing us to, that he wants us to be filled with, is mercy, purity of heart, and peacemaking. Now let's test it. Let's go on the sermon. Because in chapter 5, verse 20, he makes another statement about righteousness. I tell you, unless your righteousness, there it is again, exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. All right, here's the stakes. He's like, righteousness matters and actually has to exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. These are the people who essentially were professional do-gooders. They spent their whole lives trying to follow the laws and the customs and the traditions that they associated with the laws to be really, really good. And Jesus comes and says, it wasn't good enough. We need more. What I want to suggest to you is that from that point on in verse 21 of chapter 5 and to the end of chapter 5, you have a picture of six things that he would show us are exceeding the righteousness of the Pharisees. Look at number one, anger. You've heard it said, to those of old, you shall not murder. But I say to you, you see the standard lifted, exceeding. The Pharisees would have said, don't murder. And Jesus comes along and says, it's more than that. Something needs to happen in your heart. Now, notice where he goes with it, because he's talking about anger with his brother. We often don't read the rest of it. But what he's going to say is, we actually need to go and be reconciled. And so in verse 23, he brings sort of, he imagines a situation. If you're offering your gift at the altar, and there you remember your brother has something against you, leave it and go be reconciled. Is that not peacemaking? I think it is. Then he goes on and he talks about lust. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. That's what the Pharisees would have said. But I tell you, it's more than that. It's a look. And notice where he says, what he says next at the end of verse 28. If you look with lust, there is already adultery committed in your heart. Isn't it interesting that the second thing he said about righteousness was purity of heart? Peacemaking, purity of heart, mercy. He goes through and he talks about divorce and the Old Testament allowance because of the hardness of our heart for this. But he calls us to be like radical in our covenant keeping. He calls us to the same sort of thing in our the truthfulness of what we say next in our oaths. So he's calling us to this radical, pure living. Then he ends with teaching on retaliation and on loving your enemies. Again, you go through the list and go, hold on a second. He's just talked about six things that have to do with mercy, purity of heart, and making peace. There's your picture. You want to know what righteousness looks like? It looks like this. Now, just back to the big E on the eye chart. If we were just to end the service now and I was to say, all right, now just go out and live like this, we will fall flat on our face. Can't do it. Unless God is radically at work within my heart, I can't live like this. This is not just a moral reformation project. This is, again, think back to the beginning. This is me understanding I'm spiritually bankrupt. This is me understanding the right response to that is I will mourn. I will allow that to be so profoundly real in my life that I will be amazed that others treat me as well as they do. That will lead me to hunger for something outside of myself because I cannot fill it. And then as it is being filled by God at work within me, I will pursue these things. Now, the good news of this filling thing, as I already mentioned, he's going to stuff us with it. It'll be overflowing. That's how you're going to know that God's at work in your life. When all of a sudden you, by your own inclinations, would not show mercy or would not show or put an effort into making peace. And all of a sudden you'll one day wake up and it's like, oh, wow, God's at work. That's God. Give God credit. That's not you. That's God. And we have this glorious hope that even as we are very much an imperfect work in progress, there is a future ahead of us where we will be filled. 2 Peter, as Peter reflects on the things to come, he says this, since all these things are thus to be dissolved, in other words, everything that is going on in the world now, what sort of people ought you to be? In lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God. I don't know, you know, you can hasten the coming of the day of God. Isn't that interesting? The heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. In other words, everything's going to be transformed. Here's the verse that fascinates me, verse 13. But according to his promise, we are waiting for the new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Righteousness just lives there. It just camps out. It's not a temporary resident. It is there forever. Here's the hope we have. You hear that? Every time you look around the world and go, something is wrong with this world. There is a hope and a future ahead of us where you will never have that thought go through your head because there will be no more sin and no more suffering and no more injustice. Righteousness will dwell there forever. Jesus says we will be filled. All right, real quick. Moving on to this next statement, the statement about mercy. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Pretty sure I'm going to run out of time. But I'm going to take a stab at this one here just to kind of keep you at the same place as the first service. But I'll do it quick. Mercy as opposed to grace has a different sense to it. Grace deals with the root of the issue of sin, scripturally. Whenever you read about grace, it's typically aimed at that. Mercy deals with the consequences of sin. In other words, you commit a sin and there is a misery that comes with it. Maybe not initially, maybe initially you think it's like, this was awesome. And then eventually, as that takes root and comes to its natural outcome, a misery comes with it. Mercy is looking upon that, seeing the misery, and acting to bring about comfort. Jesus tells a story in Luke chapter 10 that illustrates it perfectly. Many of you would know the story. It's a story of a good Samaritan. It has everything to do with this young man who comes to Jesus looking to try to figure out kind of life and eternity and these kind of big questions. And Jesus, as part of his answer, tells the story of a man who is attacked and beat up and essentially left for dead at the side of the road. And then others who travel by and see him. There is a priest, a Levite, and these sort of religious officials who come by and they see him, but they don't want to do anything to intervene. Probably it's because they have this view of sin that it's like a contaminant, that once you, if you were to touch someone, it's like the sin would spread. That's kind of what their view of sin was like. It's like the playground version of cooties, for those of you who grew up in public school. It's a very difficult thing to navigate, not getting cooties from girls. But it was sort of like that. If you can kind of think of that, that's kind of the view of sin. Or boys, if you're a girl. Sorry. It goes both ways. Although in my world, I told this story in the first service. I had this one recollection where I was in kindergarten and we had two boats. And they were sandboxes, like little rowboats that had been turned into sandboxes. A girl's one and a boy's one. And I actually vividly remember the day the girl's one got eaten by ants. And so they took it away. And then all of a sudden there was one sandbox. I remember the day when the girls joined the boys' sandbox and all the boys left because we were afraid to get cooties. But this idea of sin, so how it worked, if you touched a dead body, that was a contaminant, and it had its roots in the Old Testament. They weren't making this stuff up. You go back and you read the Old Testament, you'll see this is woven into the law and instructions for God and his people. And the point is really, really clear. The point is so blatantly obvious. It's like sin, it just infects everything. You can't get away from it. But mainly because it's in you, but it's everywhere around you. But these people were actually trying. They thought they somehow could avoid it. And so they wouldn't help this man who was lying there in trouble on the side of the road. They saw him, but they wouldn't actually do mercy, right? They see, but they don't actually move to relieve his distress. And then along comes a Samaritan. We know him as the Good Samaritan. Why is he good? Well, because he does. He sees, he has compassion, and he acts. That's what mercy is. You see, there's something inside your heart that has compassion, and you don't just walk on, you act. That's what we're called to as followers of Jesus. And so he binds the man's wounds, he carries him away, he pays for his care, and Jesus says, that's what it looks like. And so to this young man, he's like, that's what I'm calling you to. That's the kind of life that my followers are going to live. That's mercy. It alleviates the suffering that comes as a result of living in a sinful world and being sinful people. Now, Micah says this. He says a wonderful statement in Micah chapter 6, verse 8. Remember this one. Many have probably already memorized it. He says this. He has shown thee, O man and woman, what is good and what the Lord requires of thee. There's three things. Many of you will know them like the back of your hand. Do justice, love mercy, walk humbly. That's a pretty good list. You want to pray for things that God would do inside your heart? It's like, God, would you make me someone who walks in humility? That's just sort of a lifetime of just humbly trusting and walking with God, of not trying to exalt myself, but exalting the Lord. It's the first two that I want to point out, just so we see them with clarity, so we hear what we are being instructed to do. Do justice and love mercy. Don't get those switched around. Don't be a person who loves justice and does mercy. Understand the difference? There are people out there who love justice, and then they will grit their teeth and they will do mercy, but they kind of wish they didn't have to because they love justice. That's a very different thing. We're to be, yes, there is a need for justice. We need to do that, but we're to be people who are lovers of mercy. Why? Well, it's because it's who Jesus was. Jesus had a number of conversations with different people in the New Testament recorded for us that have everything to do with this. One of his common statements was something along these lines. Go and find out what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. He's quoting Hosea chapter 6, verse 6 when he says that. And the whole point is in Hosea, there's a bunch of people who are doing the religious duties. They're going through all the motions, but they don't love God or others. And in fact, Hosea describes their love like the morning dew. It's sort of there and it's gone. We're called to be people who love others and who love God. And that's what Jesus is calling us to, that we would relieve people of their suffering, not just look upon them with disdain or laugh at them in their suffering, but that we would actually be moved to act with compassion.